The cycle of deliverance in the 14th chapter of Exodus is pretty amazing. It presents to us one of the most remembered miracles of the Old Testament. When you talk to people who maybe don't have a great in-depth grasp of the Bible, perhaps their understanding is superficial because of newness to the Scriptures or lack of study. And you say, well, what kind of big things happened in the Old Testament? This particular event, for any number of reasons, is visually, emotionally, and structurally a big thing for most of American culture. It probably has something to do with some movies that have played variations of it over the years that might be more recent. But even beyond the more modern context, it is a powerful story of God's handiwork. And as we laid the groundwork before, this is a series of events that are being seen on the world stage. It's no longer just a dialogue between a couple of people, because this is a grappling of nations, in many senses, in absence of the typical format. Nations went to war often through this time period. They would fight. They would appeal to their gods. The gods would be invoked. And in the end, whichever army was victorious, they would then say, well, that meant that our God was stronger than your God. That's the backdrop for some of the dialogue that you see leading up to this. Think about this for a moment. Proactively speaking, on the front of war, conflict, intrigue, spy work, espionage, research, scouting out the land. How much of that is done in the redemption of Israel by Israel to get to them this point? What do they do proactively to bring about their freedom? Have they changed their nation over for a time to war? Have the War Powers Act been put into place and the machinery to change their plows into swords gone into place? No. And as we kind of pointed out on Sunday, this is a nation that really doesn't have any insight to what war looks like. They're not like their patriarchs in that they had some connection to physical conflict. These are people who, if they saw what war looked like amongst the Philistines, God knew they would turn back. He said, they would go out. We don't want that. We're going back. But yet, by contrast to the culture that surrounds them, their God is actually helping them. So this presentation of the nation of Israel, the people of God on the world stage, is unlike anything other that they had seen. And all those secondary, smaller groups of peoples that surrounded Israel and Egypt in this area, they're seeing it all take place. The Egyptian army, and this is something else that we have to kind of capture at this point, is well suited to do one thing right now. And that's kind of the police state. It's not an army of conquest in the way in which we think about the Roman legions or other parts of historical Mesopotamian regional conflict, all the way going forward into Assyria and Babylon, which were other great warring nations in that sense. They're not that at all. But they are really good at keeping a population suppressed. You could think in modern terms of some aspects of Russian police state and Nazi police state context. And that's kind of what you're seeing here. But that doesn't mean that their army is weak. They are well prepared to take on the type of fight they would have had with the Israelites. Untrained, large numbers, but not really suited for war. They were. For the type of conflict that they were engaging in, which is pacification of a people by force, well, they got that. They have it in spades. So when the army of the Pharaoh begins to chase them, remind yourself of the level of fear that's there. This is literally the fox chasing not the hare, but the turtle. The hare can run away. The turtle's just going to have to hope that it can make it through. And so from their perspective, and the turtle doesn't have its shell. You know, it doesn't have any sense of protection from the earthly standpoint. And so inch by inch and step by step as the story unfolds, remember that as you're thinking about God is doing this in a way so much different than any of them would have personally planned it. Certainly not the young Moses. The young Moses rose up out of, you know, this righteous indignation and said, I'll solve it right now with my hands. And God is solving it with His hand, far mightier than anything that would have been in their own reach. Beginning verse 1, and that's why we had all this backdrop. It's important because we get right there into it. The Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp at Pi-Haroth between Migdol and the sea in front of Baal Zephron. You shall camp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say to the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. One thing to tie together. That initial question that was asked of the context of Pharaoh and Jehovah and Moses, who is the Lord that I should obey His voice? We already had one earlier chance to answer it. Well, now it is again. This is the best way for you to kind of tie these sections of the Scriptures together. Pharaoh asked the question, who is the Lord? The Lord's about to answer the question the final time. And this is really kind of closing the door on this section of the work of God and bringing this together. So if you're a highlighter, you're an underliner, you're a scribbler, scribble them together. Pharaoh gets his answer. That's what you underline. Whoop. Pharaoh gets his answer. And it's not going to be one that has any kind of surprise to it because he's been answering it. And then there's the other tie-in. Earlier in the whole sequence, God's going to harden his heart. God's hardening takes place in this sense by His stable answers. God says, no, let my people go. Let my people go. And Pharaoh won't do it. He won't do it. God doesn't move. And that hardens Pharaoh's heart. And God's not going to move here either. In fact, He is going to demonstrate His presence and His power even more so because He's going to seal off the last edge of that typical conversation about how a nation proves its spiritual worth. Because with no army, they have no way to prove that their God is stronger. That's the last linchpin. And that really was the final clause in the way in which these nations exhibited their spiritual dominance. Further, this tactical decision that's being made here doesn't make sense. There are some things that if you go through the history of structural warfare, modern warfare, historical warfare, if you talk to military historians, tacticians, that don't really, you know, you don't want to do put yourself in a position to be in. You know, you don't want to go into a box canyon because you can't get out. That would be a bad thing. You want the high ground. You want to make sure that you do the patent standard and get there the firstest with the mostest. You know, things like that. Really simple, basic principles that aren't really complicated. This decision here moves them into a place where they're going into a box canyon, in essence. No way to escape, no way out from the earthly sense. As much as we then will sometimes nitpick at the faith of these Israelites, they still went. Moses still led them. And so as their weaknesses are laid bare for them, for us to see, don't miss out their strength right here. This is a pretty bold move on their part. You know, to go ahead and say, okay, we'll trust. We've trusted this far, we're going to trust now. That also maybe helps us shape some of the things that will come to pass when we see them in their approaching to the Holy Land in different ways. But God is going to accomplish this plan here in these next few verses. Who wants to read verses 4 through 9 for us? I've been calling on people. We'll try to turn it up a little bit. And if you don't answer, then I'm going to make Joe read. So he's ready to go. I know he's ready. But if there's someone else who wants to read for us, you just raise your hand and you can read ahead of him right now. Oh, someone pointed at Terry. So Terry's going to read for us. I won't say who the someone was. Joe, you're next. Okay, you get ready for the next section. Terry, read verses 4 through 9 for us, please. It's a struggle word. Go ahead. I struggle with it too. Yeah. Just so you know, here's a little side point for you. Every single way you've ever heard a Hebrew or Greek word pronounced is cultural and regional to where you grew up. And they're probably all right and all wrong. Because raise your hand if you speak Hebrew. Not me either. I can read a little bit. I can't speak it at all. And if you speak Greek, you're like me. You're speaking a dead language. Nobody actually speaks Koine Greek anymore. We guess at it. So it's okay. Just go ahead and join the crowds. Realize that whatever pronunciation we agree on for the moment is probably right. All right, so here you have the way in which the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, sees all of this. And I want to point something out. Maybe we can catch it here. Let me change my angle so I can get a better view of things. This is showing in the red line that's here. This picture right here, this is the red line. This is referred to, generally speaking, as the southern route. Most folks tend to think that's probably the right route that they took in their egress from Egypt into the planned arrival at the promised land. There is one up here by the two ways, the way of the sea and the way of the shore, which is the northern route that kind of follows these gray lines right here. You can kind of see those, the gray lines. It's less common. The problem why we don't know exactly the route that they took is, one, God doesn't go into a tremendous level of geographical detail and using, you know, lat long marks and, you know, way marks and all that stuff. He doesn't tell that. He actually just uses it on the basis of a couple of cities. And the location of those cities are still kind of in archaeological history of maybe we know where they are and maybe we don't. And so we're not sure about the location of those particular places. So you can kind of see right here in this little question mark, that's why it's there. It's probably somewhere in that region. Or if you want to be even more accurate, you could say it's somewhere in that region, because that's going to cover both edges of it, from the question mark all the way to an equal distance above Ephraim. And those are guesses, because historically we're not quite sure from a historical, archaeological standpoint. This is what we do know. They did cross. They crossed in this area, and they crossed at a point that didn't make sense. So that's why people tend to put it at this lower point, because it wouldn't have made sense for them to do that. It would really trap them in there. Pharaoh's response to it is pretty understandable. They're doing what? And let's get the army together. 600 choice chariots, but not just that. And so he's chasing them, in essence, and this is the saddest part to think about it, like they were dogs. This is not going after them with a rescue clan and we're going to gradually bring them back and we're going to have a conversation about it. They send out basically the visual side of the Egyptian military. It's not that they didn't have other units at their disposal. It's not that they didn't have other means and soldiers to work in this construct. But to picture it with, we're going to send the chariots out. Well, we set the dogs out on them. And that's intentional in the sense of creating a fear standpoint. Because chariots, in part, are about creating the presence of this visual structure of we're after you and we're dangerous and we're scary and we're mean. And the chariots present that look. And so you see some of that coming to pass here. And so on the one hand, he treats them again still like his possession. But the picture that's been presented to him is, we got this. These foolish Israelites, they don't know what they're doing. Why'd they go there? You've probably all seen variations of Charlie Chan movies, the old Three Stooges, some of the Popeye stuff, where they get in the boxing ring and they start boxing it up there. And there's one boxer that always comes in and his responsibility is just kind of dodge the punches. And you see him missing all the time like it was some sort of bullfight. Well, partially it feels like the way this is presented here is that Pharaoh thinks he's going into a fight with only one real fighter. He's not really fighting against the people who have a chance. And so to him, it's this big farce. It's a big joke. They're not going to back away from it. How are they going to dodge? There's nowhere they can run away. It's almost comedy to him to think that they can survive. We have a different perspective, though, right? We know that Israel's not alone. We can appreciate they're not trained for war. God sees that about them, too. So there's more going on than the physical realm. And so in this conflict here, something to think about is parallel to the conflicts of Elisha, Jeremiah, and all the prophets. We see the physical plane coming to pass. God sees the physical plane and the spiritual plane. The physical plane is unresolved, but from God's perspective, there was no doubt that they were going to make it out. He already saw the way through the water before the arms got stretched out. He already knew the dry land was there. He led them there intentionally, not accidentally. He planned it for whatever all the reasons he did. And part of that was again answered for us in the prior section. So that Pharaoh will know who I am. Pretty powerful reminder for us today that God is that same God. That He has the same capacity to answer and to care, and to protect, and to provide for us in ways so that we know, and that those around us know, that He is the Lord. And remember when Jesus was talking a little bit at different points about the day of judgment, about what that's going to be like, every knee will bow. All will confess. It doesn't just say, yeah, those who believed me on the earth, they're going to confess that I'm Lord. All of them will. And so you kind of get a little hint of that from here being realized all the way in the future sense from here to the arrival of Christ in our own future sense beyond that. The next section here is verses 10 through 12. And Joe, do you want to read that for us?
Carry us forth out of Egypt. not a word in that we give help us be just saying, let us know that we may serve the Egyptians, for it has been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we would die in the world.
This is a powerful kind of seesaw-like circumstance. We'll go out here with Moses. We'll follow you. We'll follow you into this kind of dangerous situation where our back's to the wall, and then now their back's to the wall. And fear's really powerful, isn't it?
Well, they seem to forget about the fact that God was with them day in and day out, night in and night out, with the cloud and fire.
Yeah.
Right there, they forgot.
Cloud, fire, the hand of God in the plagues. And that's all history for them that they lived, that they walked through. But reflect for a moment how powerful fear is for you and me. If you've raised children, think about the first time they got behind the wheel of a vehicle and you were not in the car with them. Or you were, either way. Were you afraid? Were you afraid more about everybody else that was on the road with them than them? Maybe. But fear is really powerful, and sometimes fear causes the most rational and trusting people to become irrational and incredibly confused about what do I trust, who do I trust, what do I do. And then think about the first time that you were in an accident of any kind, bicycle, automobile, whatever. It was pretty scary. Took you a little few minutes to get yourself together. This is a people who has not known war. They've known suffering. They've known oppression and sorrow. God saw in them the knowledge that they weren't ready to fight a war. They weren't prepared in that sense. They were faithful enough to trust, but they hadn't matured enough to fight. And so when Egypt comes, they feel like, and you can kind of sense in the way the response is, that we've reached the end of our rope. The thread's really bare. Like there's not much holding them together. And the statement they make, are there not graves in Egypt? We could have died there. Because they don't see the way out yet. Now here's the New Testament parallel. Does God promise the believer today to provide a way of escape? Are they talking about physical things or spiritual things? Spiritual things, right? Do you get scared when you can't see it? Yeah. Like you know it's there. Because he said it's going to be here. And you start looking around for it and you're digging. He promised me. And in the gap between God promised and now I see the way, we get scared. And just like Abram and Sarah, and just like Israel right here, sometimes we make either the best decisions we've ever made or some of the worst decisions we've ever made in that gap between, I know God promised, I can't see the way yet. Now, we know, because we read the story already probably, where the way is. We know that across that water is dry land. They don't know that. But God has made a way of escape for them. And He's going to open it up. And it's going to be amazing. And their faith is going to go from like, just a wow. You got to imagine, a moment ago in the story, when we get to this point, they're thinking, we're done. Why'd you bring it? And they're going to walk by Moses and see him struggling and being helped to hold the gate, if you will, hold the gate open for them. And as they're walking, as they're moving, the same emotions that went down, they're going to stand back up again. That ebb and flow of faith and weakness and trust and maturity and patience and waiting, when you see it on an individual scale, it's pretty understandable. Large groups of people tend to act more irrationally than one person would. We call that the mob mentality. And we see it all the time. You see it whenever they open up a new cash register at Walmart or the grocery store. It's open. Everyone's over there. By the way, the smart thing to do is let everyone flee to the open one and then walk three steps forward in the gap that was created by all the runners. But here you have them doing that exact same thing. And their character here is being refined in part in the moment of despair. They had, as we kind of recognize, seen all that the mighty hand of God had done for them. But they hadn't learned to bridge the gap between God's promise and them seeing. And remember, the Hebrew letter reminds us that that really is the evidence of practical faith. Being able to trust what you can't yet see. Verses 13 and 14. Tim, do you want to read for us?
Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent."
Think about that. The Lord's going to fight for you against, while a warring nation that really is in a pacification mode in this sense, this is the strongest army there is right now. There is no Roman legion. Assyria and Babylon are on the way far future land. These people own everything that they see. And something's going to happen that they'll just have to watch. If you are intrigued, think about this phrase. This repeated phrase in the Bible always intrigued me. I want to know why. Fear not. It's a powerful repeated phrase in the Bible. I'm not going to tell you all the places it happens, but it happens a lot. Fear not. So again, you have a people who are trusting in the broad promise that they are. They're there. They're present. They left. They carried. They have the unleavened bread with them. They have the gold that was taken. They have their garments and what all that they could bring with them. Fear still rules them because they're thinking they're going to die. But the promise is back there. They haven't seen what the God they serve can do. He says, "Fear not." He calms them with the opportunity to see the salvation of the Lord. So they're going to be on the front row seat for whatever it is that God has planned. And I'll add this tidbit, and this is something I try to remind myself when I read passages when there's a singular type of miracle where it doesn't happen again. As they're standing there, the concept of the sea being parted isn't an option of experience. I don't know about you, but I get to the river sometimes with family or friends. And we joke about, you know, "Hey, let's part the sea." We go through a crowd, part the sea of the crowd, because it's a familiar thing. Oh, we know that can happen. To them, I got nothing. They're the first-time spectators. This literally is a new thing to them on all of these levels. And so they're going to see all of this with a different perspective. "And the Lord," or the King James, I think, says, "Jehovah will fight for you." They're, again, just going to be spectators. Verses 15 through 18. Roy, do you want to read that for us? I'll set to verse 18.
"And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten me upon Pharaoh, upon his chariot, and upon his horse.
All right, so we're now at a point, and the scriptures picture it kind of vaguely, but not super, you know, too hard to catch. They're close enough that they passed over the Tueller drill for an army in conflict. They're close enough where they can get them. You know, there's harm can be happening to them quickly. We're going to see that part of God's plan is not only to rescue them through His designated way of escape, but He's going to hold them back. That army that's close breathing down their necks, it's going to be like the big kid and the little kid. You know, that, you know, that little kid charging against the big giant and he grabs the forehead. The kid just goes, I can't, flails his arms. That's going to be the mighty Egyptian army with its powerful chariots charging towards Israel, with only the obvious outcome being victory and domination. And Jamie already pointed this out as an earlier point, but we can catch it again, that the practice that God set in place for them to know where to go and to know that God was there, the pillar of fire and the cloud, they're going to be used also as tools. They're going to be used as the designators to keep Egypt at bay and to lead this vast number of people through. Because no matter how big the opening is, it's going to take some time to get a nation across any kind of narrow way. It takes time. Just like you're leaving, an Atlanta game, when everyone decides, oh, we're going to stay to the end of the game, and everyone gets up, all you're going to do is get up and go to your car and sit down and wait there. Because everyone's got to funnel out through the same little tiny walkways, the same little everything. And so you just kind of herd your way along. Well, this is a larger crowd with more stressful circumstances. Do you think those folks that were crossing over on dry land were like, ooh, look at the fishies? Maybe some of them were. I probably would have been. They're fearful. They're more conservative of the freedom on the other side and the danger behind them and the wonderment of it all than, oh, vacation time. So there's an impetus. There's a pressure on that side. And when that pressure happens, you actually go slower because you're fighting every direction. You're not orderly and economically going through the space. There's that conflict of position. God's power is being demonstrated to them in a very specific and dynamic way. Verse 19 and 20, it reads, "And the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night, without one coming near the other all night." It's like the screen defense. Just kind of keeps the space. Okay, shuffle. Another sense of amazement here. Because again, from the rest of the Bible, how significantly powerful is one messenger of God? One. My general answer is, more than enough for whatever you want to do. You know, and that's why you have that power in the phrase of who could have called legions. Yeah. Like, the extent of God's power and the power of the Son of God is limitless from our persuasion. God's plan has Him doing the holding pattern. Because in the end, He has a plan for the demise of the Egyptian army. He doesn't need the angel to do that. Could he have? Whatever God wants him to do. Power restrained is what you're seeing there. And it's playing itself out again, so Israel gets to see it. Israel will see the answer of Jehovah to the hardened heart of Pharaoh as they are rescued and others are condemned. The last section of the text, you know, that broad 31 verses, we're going to kind of overview that together in some senses, but because I also want to summarize some things before class time gets behind us tonight. Jehovah is going to accomplish exactly what took place, what we know from history. The sea opens in part through a powerful or a strong east wind. And the wall is described as being two great walls. But that's the walls of the water. Various graphic artists have tried to render it. You've probably seen paintings, maybe illustrations. If your childhood included trips to the Universal Studio lots, like mine did a little bit, you know, they drove the trams down the simulated parting of the seas, and you looked over, and it was just amazing to see it there. All of that was trickery or artistry of the hand of man. This was the hand of God. And everyone had a part to play. From Moses and his role, from those who served him, but also the first Israelite who took that first step. Because you got a picture in that sense too. Everyone's pushing him behind him. We got to go. There's safety there. That guy who reaches their first step, that really, to some degrees, is an illustration of that phrase, a leap of faith. Because the waters just went back. When are they going to come back in again? They're going to come back in when we're all out there? Again, they don't know. This is all an experiential moment for them. They're walking through it. When the Hebrews had all passed through on dry ground, then Jehovah had his messengers stop. All right, they get to go now. It's like a red light, green light kind of thing. You're playing the old kids game. Okay, you're going to go now. It's not going to end like you think, though. From their perspective, they had just watched. They had just seen and could see Israel on the other side. And they're hot. I mean, they've been chasing after them. This is the people whom they have made their servants. They're hot. And so they go after them. There's not much fear there. That's anger. And God has a designed outcome for them as they're chasing and pursuing. But then it doesn't go exactly as they planned. Verse 26. Stretch out your hand over the sea that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, upon their horsemen. This is after the safety of Israel has taken place, the clogging of the chariots in the bottom of the ground. They're dragging and drudging at that point. Well, Moses stretches out his hand, and the walls that were creating safety, they close in on them. It's pretty terrifying for those people right there. You know, they're weighed down with weapons of war. Their hearts are hardened in rebellion, and it's just sealing up on them. As much as we see the triumph of the justice of God, we see the demise of a rebellious group of hearts, personified and typified by the Pharaoh himself. These were my people. I don't want them to go. I own them. They serve me. We can't survive without them, and we don't want to survive without them. It's a bit of their attitude. Well, as it closed up around them, you see that final despair. Verse 30, thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord had used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in His servant Moses. You could almost add the clause, though, by the way, for now. Because their faith kind of ebbs and flows in that sense. There's a couple of big things in this section of the text of Exodus that are really kind of valuable. Up to this point, you know, you kind of have some things to kind of preamble-wise, we haven't reached a point where God has delivered the law to them. So this is the last section of time, a little bit more that's coming up, that God has them serving Him, but He hasn't given them their standards yet. And so that's just about to happen. But even so, there is some broad pictures here that we can grasp because of that. Because Israel is, yes, a chosen people, but there is not an Israelite nation in the legal sense yet. They haven't had the full covenant spelled out to them. We see God dealing with every nation on an equal page at this point. The Egyptians, the Philistines, the Midianites, the Amorites, the Israelites, they're still all amenable to whatever God asks of them. The judgment that came upon Egypt comes in part due to the rebellion to God's request. God said, "Let my people go." Pharaoh, king of Egypt, said no. That bred part of the consequences. But also beyond that, all these other hangers-on nations that we've kind of talked about that saw the handiwork of God, this gives birth to generations down the road where, as the example of the Samaritans, still worshiping God when Christ comes. They just don't know everything. And you have Egyptians that come out of Egypt who are proselytes to the law. Outside of Israel, you still have people who were seeking God generally, and at times specifically looking for Him and waiting for Him. This is the other end of that bookshelf, this period right here, where God is still telling us about His dealings more broadly with the nations around Israel. As much as the events were a teaching moment for Egypt, it was also a teaching moment for Israel and for us. If you don't get anything else, one of the things you can get really clearly from the plagues is that God's judgments come to pass. His judgment may be specific towards one or nationally towards an entire group of people. But you can't escape from them. You're not going to run away from them. You can't impose your will above His and expect it to happen. Expect it to end up that way. Another side point to catch, and maybe one that we can walk away with, is that just as much as these Israelites were rescued and saved today, they weren't always saved. You know, you maybe heard the doctrine, once saved, always saved. They saw the salvation of the Lord on that day. But did God require them to continue to be faithful to Him? Well, yeah, He did. You and I may experience the salvation of the Lord in our life, but then He also still requires for you and I to stay faithful to Him. And so this is just a good hint to that broader theological idea of obedience and faithfulness to God. It's not a one-time thing, it's a lifetime thing. That's it for our time. Class period is over, and so we'll have to stop here. We will pick up in chapter 15 on Sunday. Thanks, everybody.